Hey guys, you're listening to the Goggler Podcast. Ian Bahir and Uma with you with a week's worth of reviews. Here's what we've been watching this week. The upcoming Netflix series, Ju-on Origins, HBO's I'll Be Gone in the Dark, and an Amazon Prime original called 7500. We're going to kick things off with Ju-on Origins with our local J-horror correspondent, Ian McNally, who has seen more Ju-on / Grudge movies than anyone else. But Netflix were kind enough to give us all of the episodes to this upcoming series. It is obviously a prequel series, as you can tell from the name. And admittedly, I have to say, I was apprehensive because I'm like, there's so many of these already. This is not going to scare me anymore. Boy, was I wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw the original Ju-on after I'd exhausted all of the available Ring movies at that time, which was, right. You know, that was a hell of a week.
Nightmare week at the McNally household.
Yeah, I caught up a bits and pieces with them over the years, and I only recently watched the 2020 one with John Cho and Andrea Riseborough.
Yeah. But it was also Sam Raimi, right?
Yeah, it was the harbinger of the apocalypse because that was like, you know, that came out just before all the COVID stuff happened.
But any good? Was that any good?
No, because it does exactly what all the other Ju-on movies do, which is there is long hair creeping out of a bathtub. There's small children. There's cat noises. And what's brilliant about this series is it reinvents all that stuff without, you know, without it does not rely on those things at all. And it reinvents the classic
noise
that they make in those movies. They'd reinvent that in really interesting ways. They take everything about it. I mean, the core is still there. A trauma happens that is so bad, or if you die in the grips of a powerful rage, then a curse is born. And from that point onwards, just anyone who's in the story is essentially fucked. I mean, it's even more depressing than The Ring. I mean, this is not spoilers, but The Ring is like, you know, the kid, the big twist in The Ring is the psychic kid in every version says you weren't supposed to help the ghost. In this, it doesn't matter. It's like it's the ultimate nihilist ghost story. It's like no matter what you do, if you set foot in that house, there is a 99.9% chance you're going to die horribly or else be whisked away to some terrifying limbo thing. And it's fun.
This thing premieres on July 3rd, which is next week. But I have to say, I am so used to watching, I guess, American shows now with all of their trigger warnings and such that I almost know what to expect when I switch on an episode. But with Ju-on being made entirely in Japan, it feels like they have somehow removed themselves from that discourse because the shocks just came at you hard and fast. The way the first episode ends, I won't spoil it, was something that I guess we would hardly see that depiction on American TV. It would feel like the camera would cut away from it.
Mm. You would, and they did. Maybe it's the Quentin Tarantino ear cutting scene where you're thinking there's more to. Like they do cut away from some things and leave a little bit to your imagination at the end of that.
But then at the beginning of episode two,
the follow up
to that is incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, and the thing is, you would see this on a HBO detective drama. You would not see it in a ghost story or an investigative ghost story. Like there is an element of investigation to this. It's not the core of it because they don't care about spooky X-Files. It's literally just a thread.
Okay, so obviously I didn't watch this. If you're a long-time listener to our podcast, clearly I don't watch horror. Break down the show. What is this series compared to like what is a Ju-on film?
So the series essentially tries to retell the origins, as it's in the title, of this curse, right?
And it should be said, it kind of does so in like one of the most hackneyed kind of TV setup ways. You know, there's a voiceover explaining that Ju-on was based on a real story, and it actually says, but the truth was far scarier than any movie. And you're like, The death rattle noise was the eyeballs rotating in my skull just from like, ugh, this is such a bad start.
But it doesn't actually fall into those kind of hoary tropes or cliches because you meet these characters and it feels, I think that investigative trope really works because you're introduced essentially it's hard to say who's the main character because the series kind of jumps back and forth in time a lot to tell various stories.
Right. Oh, and the key theme by here is that realtors are fucktards because essentially they all, nobody ever tells anyone, oh, by the way, the people who lived in this house before you, oh, died horribly, horribly, just, oh, blood, murder, everything.
They're just trying to make money, man. They're just trying to make money.
Though I have to say, there was this one really funny line where the guy just went, yes, but given property prices in Tokyo, no one really cared given how cheap the house was.
It was like, did you ever set foot inside? No. Because it can be just that, though. Even just visiting the house, if you set foot inside the house,
right,
you can be doomed, or you can live there quite happily for a couple of months before you're doomed. And it kind of, a couple of characters thread their way through the story as like, one character is trying to find this house. They're an investigator and they're trying to find it. There's another character who kind of you follow as like, doesn't get eaten by ghosts, but their life maybe would have been better if they had, because the shit that happens to them as they grow up is not great. And they just weave these stories through with like, there are new people and you're thinking, wait, when is this? And there's like, you find people dead that you're like, wait, we haven't seen those people's story. So there's mysteries within mysteries, wheels within wheels. So it is weird to see it revamped as a TV show. I didn't think it would work at the first, but as it went on, it's not like I'm gripped by these characters, but the plots, the way they juggle these balls and the way that the scares seem to be, I'm not going to go back and watch this again, but the scares seem to evolve as the series goes on. Did you notice that?
Yeah, no, I think the way they evolve the plot, the way they play with structure as well in telling these stories. Like Ian said, sometimes you meet a character and you're like, wait, I haven't met you yet.
Or have I? Did they see you when you were younger? Is there a different haircut?
Exactly. And then the next episode will explain their story. But as for the scares, the thing which I liked about Ju-on in the way it reminded me of like The Haunting of Hill House was that they showed you the scare. It didn't kind of jump out at you and scare you. You saw it walking slowly towards you and you're still terrified because you can feel it coming closer. Mm. And I think that's really impressive because it doesn't rely on the same old kind of stuff, right?
But it does. I thought when you mentioned that to me off before we recorded, and I watched that some at the beginning, there are some that just get you. There is a quick cut. I was watching a video about The Shining recently. I can't remember which video put that up, but there was something in The Shining how they show the people's reaction to the horror before they show the horror.
Right.
They do that a little bit in this, but as it evolves, there's in the second last episode, there's a woman at a window. You know what I'm talking about? There's a glass door, which is, I had to, when I looked at the old trailer for The Grudge, that is an effect or a trope from the series. But the way that they used it was just visually made me, my skin is crawling right now. Only The Ring usually does this when I talk about Sadako coming out of the bloody television. And there is just, there's a scene in broad daylight. You know, the father thing?
Yeah.
Whatever happens to some fathers. And that is just like, it's not in keeping with anything that's happened before. It's broad daylight. It's not ghosts. Mm. It's not anything else. Something just happens. And I really, really thought of David Lynch, like some of the unsettling imagery that he had in Twin Peaks, The Return. It was just like that, where these things just like, they're so unnatural. It's not gore. It's not blood. It's not makeup. It's so unnatural and baffling. It's like the kind of Lovecraftian. I'm not talking about tentacle monsters, but I'm talking about something that makes so little sense, your brain recoils in horror, which is what the show wants to do.
And so much of the show actually takes place in the daytime, which I think is really impressive, especially in crafting those scares. With Ju-on as well, and with the series, it is so refreshing that they did not go back. I mean, there are enough Easter eggs in there if you're fans of the franchise, but they did not recycle any of those old scares. And I think that so much of credit needs to go to that, right?
Yeah. I mean, considering it's guys who, some of the writers and crew worked on the original Ju-on, The Grudge, which itself was, if you don't know about here, it was the third time that director told that story. He told it twice, direct to TV or video or CDVD or whatever they were back then. Then he got a theatrical thing. Then he did it a couple more times. Then he directed the American version. And he's not involved in this one at all, as far as I can tell.
Right. But also, there are like 13 different versions, right? Yeah. And spin-offs and right. side quests and everything.
Yeah. And the first American version with Sarah Michelle Gellar, I think, did I tell you this off last week or? Just it prompted one of the biggest laughs I've encountered in the cinema, where at the beginning it just has Bill Pullman wistfully looking off into the sunset before he just jumps off a very low balcony, and it just, like, the crowd erupted in laughter because it just did not land at all. The mundanity of it all, just the look of it as well, I think that's something that has been in the Ju-on series. I can't remember if they lost it over time, but it does look like a normal, it could be a Midnight Diner, you know, it's so right. normally shot. Again, yeah. that Sam Raimi produced recent Grudge version, it's like there's yellow tones on things, there's shadows everywhere.
Yeah.
This is like, no, this is the normal house. And they reinforce that, I think, really cleverly by having TV just having bad news on all the time. Did you notice that?
Yeah, yeah.
There's just like Chernobyl, earthquakes, and they're the real things that happened at those times in the show, which, again, it adds to that grounding so that when something horrible does happen, especially in these pokey Japanese houses where there's nowhere to run, it really does, it brings the horror home, as they say.
Word of warning, though, to anyone who wants to watch this, there is some truly disturbing imagery in this series, throughout the series.
Content warnings, I think what we got. We got child babies. Abuse, spouse abuse. Oh, I'd forgotten about the baby stuff because I was just a week ago. Thanks. Thanks, that's my day ruined. There is some, I think I said it in my review, right? Pregnant ladies, do not watch this. There is multiple pregnant women in this, and the stuff that happens is just, it's horrifying. I mean, it works, but I don't want to have to think about it again. And I like these kind of movies.
But that being said, and I have to say, it doesn't feel exploitative, and that's because of the way it's written and the way it's shot. It doesn't feel like gore for the sake of gore or murder for the sake of murder. Everything works within these characters. When a character makes a decision, if you've watched the previous episodes, you know exactly why they're doing what they're doing. And I think that is a testament to really good writing. And also the fact that if you want to make a horror series or movie, you have to make it truly horrifying, because these people do not conform to normal human standards, right? They're supposed to be monsters, ghosts, pure, the epitome of all that is evil.
Yeah. So is this... Again, I don't watch horror, let alone J-horror, but from what I've heard from people, they've been a very... The horrifying or the horrorness of Japanese horror films have sort of tapered off. They felt very safe lately. They felt just jump scares. They haven't stuck with you the way, say, the first Ring does to a lot of people who saw it on VHS. Does this bring that back? Listening to you guys talk about it, it feels like this is a real throwback to when the title J-horror meant something.
Yeah, because those original movies, the Ringu, Dark Water, I mean, if you go off into, I think it was Danny and Oxide Pang, which is just the best brother's name, I think they did The Eye. There was the Korean movie, A Tale of Two Sisters. All of these were reactions to what came before, but they became tropes that then propped up bad movies. So, like, the whole point of the Ring was there literally is no escape, and some of the imagery, like some of the scares in the Ring are what happens to the victims when they die, and it's just this horrifying contorted face. It's only on screen for a second, enough to lodge itself in your memory and wake you at 3 a.m. for the rest of your life. And that was, you know, that was in a reaction to the times of the Freddies and the Jasons, and how those had been, and the Scream as well. I mean, they were, you know, Scream had already made most of those tropes funny or no longer scary. They did that again, where it's like there is no escape. There is this, it's not jump scares, it was unrelenting, just dread.
Yeah.
Just feeling of unease.
Yeah.
This, watching this, especially with headphones on, I got chills down my back at just the visuals of certain scenes, the look, even just the acting, the actors reacting to this stuff, the horror that they get. Like, it gave me that. It gave me that fresh hit of that J-horror bong, right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It gave me that feeling that this is something fresh, this is something scary that I've not seen before. It's the roller coaster thing. Once you've gone on the, like, 120-foot death loop, you know, the 110-loop death loop doesn't really do it for you anymore. You need to go to the 150 death loop, double death loop, you know what I mean? And this, I think, does that without just being an escalation in, you know, more gore or more jump scares. It actually thinks about how do we want to top what's gone previously, and let's do it in a clever way.
Yeah, Exactly what he said.
And it's directed by a guy who did like music documentaries and rom-coms, which is nuts.
What?
Yeah, there's no horror on his CV at all. What's his name? I think it's Shomiaki.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he did like, if I was looking at his credits like, what? Huh? What? He's been harboring some dark secrets.
Duo and Origins premieres on Netflix on July the 3rd. If you are a horror fan, we highly recommend you watch this. But, you know, we've warned you about content. So please don't watch this with your children ever.
And also, I'd say it does... I wasn't into it in the first episode. I think it's only the second, maybe. Give it two episodes. It's almost the Netflix trope, right? Give it three episodes. But this is only six episodes long. But... yeah, I think the first episode is a bit slow and doesn't quite sell you on the horror, but it builds as it goes.
All right, up next, we're going to be talking about a brand new true crime documentary on HBO. It's called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It's based on a book by Michelle McNamara, which was released in 2018. Michelle McNamara, if you don't know, was the wife of Patton Oswalt. She passed away, sadly, I think in 2018, if I'm not mistaken. But she wrote this book because she was obsessed with true crime. And she had, she was one of the earliest people to start a true crime blog back in the early 2000s. And it was called True Crime Diary. And she eventually became obsessed with the, I guess, the rapist and killer that they call the Golden State Killer. And it was a story she felt that not many people knew, even though this guy who had gone unknown and uncaught for decades had raped over 50 women and murdered 12 people. And it was due to her work, her independent investigations, and this book that they eventually arrested a suspect in 2019, late 2018 or 2019. And so this documentary kind of chronicles this story and her obsession. It's a little twofold in the sense that one part of it is a true crime documentary about the Golden State Killer, or as he was known, the original Night Stalker or East Area Rapist. He went by many names. But also about this one woman's obsession and her incredible ability to kind of, you know, find threads and blend information and see things that other people couldn't because of her encyclopedic knowledge of true crime and unsolved murders. It's six episodes. Each one is about an hour. And I'm a huge fan, like, of the series just because of the way it's structured. I think it's quite different from the... It doesn't feel as sensationalist as some of the... of, like, you know, The Staircase or Making a Murderer. I like those a lot. But those are always like a dum-dum-dum.
Yeah.
And this one feels like it's more on an even keel. It feels better paced in telling the story.
Yeah.
I think someone makes a comment about her writing because she... this whole... Her ties to this case got publicity when she wrote an article, I think it was for Los Angeles Magazine, is that what it was? And someone writes about, like, it isn't ghoulish. It isn't sensational, her writing. It was kind of natural, and her voice was coming through a lot. I think you're underselling something there, Uma, when you say that he was known by these different names. I think she... The series, kind of going into it, I kind of thought there was she had more of a part in it. Her book does chronicle her investigations, but the links to actually... I don't want to talk ill of the dead, but, like, you know, the links to how they actually caught the guy, you know, she kept it in the public eye, yeah. I'll admit to that. But, like, the actual how they caught him was, like, submitting DNA to GED match and stuff like that. Like, there is Correct. Elements of that. So I found that slightly weird. But she was one of the ones who helped tie together these multiple cases that were
across
the same
separate,
person. It looked like the
towns,
same...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, separate towns because, oh, the cops do themselves no favors in the 70s. And also Santa Barbara, you know, last Jew on Origins, fuck realtors, this show, fuck Santa Barbara. They were all like, oh, we're not reporting all these rapes and murders because of, you know,
Reagan.
Property values. Yeah.
Jeez. We don't want to scare people.
Yeah. But it has to be said, though, it is slick as all hell. And while I haven't watched those other shows because... I kind of had my fill with crime stuff with Serial and S-Town.
Right.
Like, and when you listen to those podcasts, that's this format.
Yes.
Yes.
Very
yes.
much so.
Yeah. Yeah. This is more along the lines of, yeah, S-Town and Serial because the author slash narrator is very personal into this. Whereas Making a Murderer and Staircase, you never hear the narrator. There is no narration. It's being, the story is being carried by the characters in that story. And I think that's why I thought this was quite different. I enjoyed this a lot. I didn't think I would, actually. I thought that the narration and her own personality coming through would be a problem because I thought that I would just prefer the straight up academic look at this is what happens when these things happen. But yeah, I really fell down the hole with this one. I slept really late last night watching, I think I'm at episode 4 or episode 5.
Right.
And man, you don't want to watch this before you go to sleep.
And you do not want to binge watch this.
You do not want to binge watch this.
You know, this is a nice cheery podcast. Listen, just pure unrelenting horror from show to show. There's a point where it's just like you're seeing all these victims, and it's terrible because it's a terrible thing the television can do to you, where you're kind of blanking out on them in the first couple of episodes because you're seeing people and it's going across them all. But the sheer number and horror of the crimes is like, as you said, I think it's 50 women over the course of like from 77 to 86 or something like that.
Yes.
And just the nastiness of these crimes. Like, this person was breaking into people's houses, tying them up, and then like, wasn't playing power games, but the way that they were talking to them, there's an episode opens with like a tap they had on the phone where they just recorded something, and it's chilling. It's terrifying the way they talk. Just, and the to hear this voice in your home, it really brings home something about, you know, the social contract that these houses you see in America where, you know, the huge estates where there's no fences between them. Think about E.T., right? Where they're just building those houses. Or you see houses where there's no, when they build new houses, there's very rarely a fence so that the landline can be in dispute between houses. It's a trope that turns up in TV shows or in real life an awful lot of the time. And this idea that your home is your castle and it can be so easily torn away is horrifying.
The series also looks into, I guess, the way life changed during that period as well. And it intercuts between news footage of how, when news of the East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer started breaking, people suddenly had a greater affinity to keeping guns in their home. They started looking at alarm systems. The thing that blew my mind, of course, was that people didn't have locks on their doors.
Because they
just said, well, I just lived in a very safe world. And
because the cops were lying about it.
and you know, that was one of my greatest shocks as well, because I remember going to New York as a kid with my family, and we were living with family friends who were in a really, I guess, affluent neighborhood in Long Island, and they didn't have fences between the houses. Yeah. And that's the thing that
drives
mind.
Me nuts, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was just like, wait, I don't understand. Like, are you not scared someone's just going to like walk in and do stuff? And and in America, of all places. And it's interesting because this is one individual, right? And you can track how the conversation, the discourse, behavior all started to change across the state because of this crazy dude.
Even one of the victims say it themselves that this is what essentially changed the 70s for a lot of people, right? The end of that innocence of not locking your doors, not locking your car door, being all neighborly, to now suddenly everybody should have a gun, everybody should have multiple deadbolts on their doors and their windows and stuff. And it's weird to look back at that time now because we all have deadbolts on our door. We don't trust the guy next to us, especially now in COVID when you don't know the guy next to you is God. But at that time, it was such an innocent time that they could just, it just felt so weird watching that.
Yeah. But coming off the 50s and 60s, they were innocent, but it was also like, these things were happening, they just weren't being reported on. Which is a scary thing as well.
It's true.
Like, you see how, again, I'm not sure I get the cops all episode, but like, there are horror, again, it's just mundane horror in the fact that like the killer moved from one area to another, and like some of the attitude was, well, he's not doing it here anymore, so we'll try and get this
They've
to go
moved
away.
On.
Or just not tying links together and stuff. It just
not even talking between between police stations, right? They're not
yeah.
sharing information. They're making fun of the last guy because he couldn't catch him, but we will. It's just such weird machismo with the police.
Oh, no. And I think that's particularly interesting because I think it was one of the writers at Los Angeles Magazine who makes all of these points. And she talks about how, yes, there was no communication because of jurisdiction. And of course, he was smart enough to yeah. keep crossing jurisdictional lines because he knew detectives weren't talking to each other. But also the point she makes was we didn't have the tools nor the culture to be yeah. able to talk to these victims. And, you know, that is so clear. There's this one particular interview they do with a husband and wife who are both victims. And the camera looks at the husband every time the wife is talking. And he's so, like, you can see him about to cry because he's blocked all of this out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that was the macho thing to do back in the 70s.
I don't even know if he was going to cry. I kept thinking he was going to walk out of the room.
Yeah, there's just like I got that as well, where he's just like, you can see kind of panic on his face almost because he doesn't know how to deal with this still
yes.
50 years later. And she's working through it by talking. And I think we're burying the lead a little bit and saying, like, Patton Oswalt runs through this a lot because Michelle McNamara was his husband. And he talks a little bit about, I think, grief and how talking about it makes it feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does happen for all these victims as well. Some of them, you only find out later, never wanted to talk about this or never wanted to come out on TV talking about it. Or, you know, there's one of them who gets shouted at by her dad for telling a friend what happened to her. Like, she was one of the early victims who got raped as opposed to murdered. Yeah. And, like...
Yeah, her dad heard her on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talking to a friend, and you're not supposed to, because, you know, the taboo and everything, right?
Do you guys think in any way, though, that this is slightly dangerous? In, like, it shows later on there's, like, Crime Con and stuff like that. And while Michelle McNamara was incredibly good at sifting through information and tying links together, also had a personality where she could win over a lot of police officers. Like, there's numerous stories of her talking to somebody who's initially very hostile, and then once they talk about some stuff and she knows what they're talking about and can follow up with some, trying to link some things together that surprises them, she wins them over.
Yeah.
But do you think this will inspire more, they have it, citizen detectives? There's quite a few in this show.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of that title card, you know, citizen detective. Let's be fair, these guys are, you know, just slightly tamer than vigilante, you know. And that's what's scary, right? That idea that with the information at hand now, with all these, you know, at one point someone refers to the online forums as a mind hive. And it's great when it works out, but so much when it doesn't work out, you know. It's just, this is just shy of before people start swatting each other's houses. And
yeah.
And I think that's, I don't know if this, a show like this, is making it seem like it's something people should do in their off time. But I know what you're saying, because that was the same kind of discourse when Making a Murderer first hit Netflix and first started going out there in society. There was a lot of sort of response to how the show makes crime seem sexy. Make crime seem entertaining, you know, and that's a little, you know, when you hear there's a podcast out there that's just solely dedicated to finding unsolved crimes, it does make you feel a little grimy.
Oh, the thing that got me was I thought, like, I think I was thinking about this from watching it from the start, because it is very, this show is hella slick. But when it got to the episode where it reveals Crime Con, then I was like, oh, the horse is bolted, the barn is, oh, there's a Crime Con. And when you see that, it's like, oh. And it's surprisingly, like, the audience is like 85-90% young women.
Yeah. Actually, there's more than one. Like, there are these cons all over the world now. Lots in Europe and the US. So I went down a rabbit hole after I read the book in 2018. And I was doing all this research into, like, these forums and stuff. And it's really interesting because they exist. And, like, they're huge. So what I'm saying is there are people out there doing it. I don't know if this show is going to impact the audience and add to that in any way, because this community is already massive.
Yeah.
And yes, not everyone is as responsible. Like, you see the people that Michelle McNamara deals with. I mean, you know, they're like, oh yes, we've already looked into that person, but we've ruled them out. And they kind of work closely with cops as much as they can and try to follow proper procedure. But I think you're right, Bahia. There are a bunch of people out there who probably think, I'm going to solve this by myself.
Yeah.
I think we can rest easy in the fact that the vast majority of them are probably keyboard warriors. And what made Michelle McNamara quite unique was the fact that, you know, she would just get in her car and drive places so that she could actually look at scenes of crimes, and she would fly to different parts of America to actually do proper investigative work. And which is probably why the cops as well as the other citizen detectives warmed to her so easily, right? Yeah. Because they respected her methodology, probably.
I mean, I already had it in my notes, I think, after the first episode. It's like, does it differ much from the book?
No.
Uma? Because obviously, Uma has read the book.
Yeah, no. No, it's a very faithful adaptation. Where it differs, of course, is the book, she wrote the book. So you don't get self-glorification on her part. She's not like, I'm so awesome.
So, but all those stuff about the stuff about her family and her own history with things is like, that's
with
all
her,
part of the book as
with
well.
Her, with her daughter, and she talks about Patton and, you know, how it would really affect her day-to-day life, and all of that's in there. But what I like about the series as well is that I guess it gives us an idea of why she was different and why she was special as a journalist and a writer. And, and how she did her work. I think that was interesting insight to have in a show like this, because like you said earlier, Bahe, with Making a Murderer, with the staircase and stuff, we're not aware of the writerly process of it. We just kind of see the footage and some narration from time to
time.
And I think
this one really delves into the writerly process, because like you said, Uma, this isn't just an investigation. It's an investigation told by a person, by the investigator, but this documentary also shows the horrific effects of that process on the writer, you know? And I love that the text conversation she have with Patton is painful to see. How she's like, oh my God, I've barely slept in 2 days. It's okay, I've got drugs, you know.
Yeah, because of the nightmares she finds photos in a box from crime scenes.
Yeah, so it's not just a, hey, look at all the hard work I'm doing. It's this thing is tearing me apart. You know, there are points where she's freaking out about why the doors were unlocked, and then it was just the cleaner saying, oh yeah, I just took out the garbage, I'm going to lock it back up now. You know, Patton and her talking over email about whether or not they should get a gun.
Yeah.
So you see the, you know, it almost, you almost, you know, you don't almost, you actually see her descent into, I won't say madness, but to the point, to the brink of it, to the brink of just it affecting her to that crazy level. And that, I think, really makes the documentary. I wasn't sure if I was more interested in finding out, or if they will find out the Golden State Killer, or what happens to her. I think the show sort of really balances it out very well, because, like you said, Ian, there's a lot of very personal moments in there about her relationship with her mother, about her not sure if she's being a good enough mother to her own daughter, and that, yeah, that's really, really interesting. Really well done.
A lot of the voiceover narration is lifted directly from the book. It's text from the book, and it's voiced over by Amy Ryan, of course.
She should be working more. She's the bomb in the wire.
That's right. and also, you haven't seen The Office, but she's Michael Scott's girlfriend in The Office as well. But she's also worked with Liz Garbus, who is the creator of this show, in another true crime-inspired mystery show called Lost Girls, which was on Netflix. Also, a pretty decent show came out earlier this year in 2020 about an unsolved mystery as well. So I think, and I think that works. Amy Ryan is being Michelle McNamara, but at the same time, the reenactments, there's a joke early on about how, you know, you all remember those shitty reenactments in those shows we used to watch where some woman's in lingerie and then she gets attacked by a guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a very weird American thing. I don't know that we didn't see that on Crime Watch in the UK and Ireland.
A bit more gritty and raw.
Working class. Yeah. Something else I really liked, the opening credits are amazing, and it I had to go back and check. It is Amy Mann singing Leonard Cohen's Avalanche over the beginning, because I heard it immediately, and then I got to the later episodes. It just says, we have the preview version, it says credits. Like, crap, I have to go back to the beginning to find out if that's her or not, because there's no... That's a new version. I can't seem to find anything online.
Oh, really? Oh, they must have recorded it for the show.
Yeah, I think so. And another trope that needs to die for 2020 is emotionally springing Damien Rice songs from the early 2000s on me in the middle of shows that I was not expecting. Money Heist did it and destroyed me, I think, with The Blow His Daughter, I think it was, or something else. And in this one, there's one in the final episode that just was like, ah, I can't be doing this.
No, I have to say, though, I mean, HBO, one of the few places that still do great opening credits. Everyone else keeps it short because you can just skip intro. But I like the opening credits to Perry Mason. I like the opening credits to this one. Plot Against America had great opening credits.
Yeah, but they've kept it tight.
Yeah, but it's very atmospheric. And they use that concept of moving a light behind some trees so the shadows creep incredibly well.
Yeah.
That's really great.
So just because it's in my head, and it's speaking of credits, I have to get this out there. We started watching Midnight Diner on Netflix.
Yeah.
And like, I think if we're watching something like Modern Family, I think the option to skip the intro is always there in Netflix. But for Midnight Diner, if we come back the following day and start watching, that option is never there the first time. And I don't know if that's a choice, because I think these episodes have been only added recently. They added the original series onto Netflix in 2020, apparently.
It's the same. It's the same with when I was watching the new Brazilian series Girls from Ipanema. When you watch them in a row, you get to skip subsequent ones.
Yeah.
But then when I went back the next day, the first episode you can't skip.
So is it across the board? I don't remember this happening before. Or is this a Mandela effect thing where I've just been not paying attention?
I don't know. But I noticed it with Most Beautiful Thing or Girls from Ipanema as well.
Huh.
Yeah.
I mean, does that show require you to get into a vibe that the credits... Cause like,
yes, it does.
Because Midnight Diner, I'll have to go back and see if it does it for Modern Family. Because Modern Family is like, you can skip the intro and no problem. Like, it doesn't really add anything. Yeah. It's not like you have to be... But like, Midnight Diner is so ridiculously chill that like hearing guitar strings while the dude tells you, you know, it's going to be a chill show is kind of part of the experience. It's
borderline ASMR, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's cooking ASMR.
Yet another winner from HBO. I'll Be Gone in the Dark debuts June 29th exclusively on HBO Go and HBO, which is on Astral Channel 411, at same time as US, so you can watch it either at 10:05 in the morning, or you can wait for the encore later that night at 11:05 p.m.
Try and watch it at 10:05 in the morning.
Yeah, if you're at all skittish, you need a day's worth of stuff to get like some of the horror out of your brain before bedtime.
Yeah, it's
a week on week
really
release,
sad.
So at least you've got time to process.
That's
right.
True. Yeah,
don't wait till the end to binge.
The book is also incredibly well written. I mean, you get a sampling of it when you hear Michelle McNamara read it or speak about it in the show. Like, I was hooked when I got that book, and I think I remember finishing it in one sitting because it was just so compelling. And yet again, it's a story like we've heard of the Zodiac Killer, we've heard of Son of Sam, and all of these famous American serial killers. But this is one that just went under the radar, and his crimes were absolutely atrocious. So check it out. I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It's a HBO original documentary. Up next, we're going to be talking about an Amazon Prime original. This one's called 7500. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It's his first lead role in a long time. And he plays a co-pilot who is in the middle of a hijacking, and I guess the twist in the show is that pretty much all of it takes place in the cockpit. And it's a little bit like being buried alive, only you're not. this one was directed by Patrick Volrath, and I don't know whether I have ever seen a hijacking show like this. Because, you know, it's always like, let's take a look at the lives of the passengers and the inner lives of the hijackers. And what's that stewardess doing? And this has none of that. It is just from the get-go using a very clever trope of just looking at passengers through CCTV footage straight into the plane and then boom.
I think I see. Have I just accidentally, am I reviewing all the low budget movies from now on? Is it like I have Vasta Knight, I had Ninja and Casa, and now I have this? It's like, this wasn't even intentional. I didn't know it was going to be like this.
It seems to be your go-to.
Yeah, Ian. But it is a genius idea. Like, you never leave that. And some of the scenes with Joseph Gordon-Levitt just screaming at a tiny television are amazing. But I don't know. It didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that tense, right?
So I was tense for the first hour.
Mm.
And then I looked when I thought everything was done. And I'm like, there's still 37 minutes left?
Yeah, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that last act was a little too long.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because at that point, I was just screaming, where are the snipers? Surely there are snipers.
Yeah. Well, that's an element of predictability as well, right? Once a certain relationship is introduced, you have a good idea how that's going to play out. And once, I mean, that's kind of the final, not the nail in the coffin, but that's the final nail in this is the type of movie it is when you know what happens to that relationship, right? And it is, it's not, I've overused the word horrifying, so I can't look up the thesaurus because it'll make too much typing noises. But it is kind of creepy. There's that guy, Paul Wallen is the actor's name, the skinhead terrorist, who just looking into the camera, the screen that Joseph Gordon-Levitt looks at is like the spy cam that looks down above the pilot door so you can see who's outside. Yeah. And like, you see the terrorist mostly just through that. And him just staring at that camera is pretty goddamn scary. But then you saw that quote that I put in my review, did you?
There's
a quote from Joseph Gordon-Levitt saying that like they shot it kind of as like they're all reacting. And I think that might have been some of the problem. It's hard not to compare it to something like Into the Night because it's set on a plane. But that had like constantly ratcheting tension. And I didn't feel that in this. Was there music? I didn't even notice there was music. If there was, it was very well in the background. But like, it is very real. But as a result, it doesn't feel like a movie in a way. I don't know, I wasn't excited to watch this. I wasn't terrified. I wasn't worried on their behalf.
About halfway through, well, not even halfway, but maybe about a third of the way through the film, I'm thinking to myself, why is this movie here now? It felt like it to me. It really feels like an early 2000 movie, you know, the
TV movie,
the idea. Well, TV movie or not, but it's this idea of that, you know, spoiler alert, you know, terrorist attack hijacking thing. It just feels like, aren't we past that as a storytelling trope? Aren't we past that as a as a threat right now? Right? I don't know why this movie has been released in 2020. It doesn't do anything for me. It didn't do anything for me at all. I think it just felt.
I think some of the problem had to do with the fact that it felt like it was in real time, because I think that removed a lot of the tension in the film. See, for me, the core tension of the film is in the new rule, right? I guess after 9/11, they reinforced those pilot doors, so no matter what, you can't get in. It's bulletproof and all of that stuff.
Despite the constant hammering, like that hammering, is a very...
Yeah,
cool effective thing. You don't know what they want. All you know is they want in, and it's just constant bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also this new rule that under no circumstance do you open that door ever, no matter what is happening outside. And for me, that was the core tension, because obviously they needed to play with this notion of, do I sacrifice? How many people do I sacrifice out there, right?
Yeah.
But that was resolved almost too quickly for me, and it felt that undercut the tension because there was 40 minutes left to go in the movie.
And the terrorists like walked straight out of the big book of stereotypes for terrorists. Yes, like there was no nuance to them at all.
Yeah.
When one of them just shouts Allahu Akbar, I'm like, really, man? Come on. This is like borrowed script from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean, right? It feels like a movie from 2008, 2006, where it's still trying to cash in on the Muslim terrorists trying to take over a plane. I think in 2020, there's no nuance there to make it worth retelling in this time.
You guys watched Ryan Reynolds in 2010's Buried, right?
I still haven't watched that yet. I kept meaning to.
I haven't yet, no.
So that was directed by Rodrigo Cortez, and it was one of those, I think it was produced by Shyamalan. It was his comeback kind of thing, right? I think he did that, and then he did an elevator movie. Both of those were really quite thrilling.
Was it the elevator? I always get that confused with the one with someone, I think it was Colin Schumer made a joke where it's all these people stuck on an escalator.
That'll be a short film.
Yeah, it was a very short film.
But Buried was one of those things that really worked well because, you know, it kept its running time short, low budget, like I think it was like $3 million or something.
It's
and
one set, isn't it?
It is.
It's just the coffin.
Right? Exactly.
Well, they need the cameras in the coffin, so.
Yeah, and the most you had to do was pay Ryan Reynolds. And so much of it is
back then he was cheap.
Yeah, so much of it is lit by the light off his phone, you know, where he has no reception and he's trying to get stuff. And that really worked with the confines of space really, really well. Mm. And for me, it felt like the cockpit of an airplane is almost a little too big. Like, there's still so much you can do within that space. There's still outside communication. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that undercut the claustrophobia that the director was trying to go for.
Yeah, but I think that's also just like editing and stuff. It doesn't build tension on it. Like just being in that space, yes, you have a tight confined space, but you also have to, with music and with everything else and different angles and stuff, like there's ways of building up that tension. I don't know, it's just like lots of close-ups of Joseph Gordon-Levitt sweating. I don't know, but I didn't feel that, you know? I mean, and again, I hate comparing, you know, movies that are similar, but Into the Night, yes, it has a slightly fantastical premise, but like the tension there was so much down to the music, so much down to the acting, so much down to just the pressure of like cutting between these people and having arguments and stuff like that. And just none of that was here.
Yeah, this feels like it could have been quite an interesting short film. The idea of just seeing the pilot's point of view. And I think it would have been quite an interesting attempt at a short film, but dragged out. I think this movie feels dragged out.
That being said, I still really enjoy watching Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
No problems with his performance. Like, he's totally gripping the whole way through. It's just the rest of the movie around him isn't.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because I'm usually a fan of these sorts of concept pieces, but they're far harder to pull off. $7,500 is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Check it out. Let us know what you think when you've seen it. It's about 90 minutes, so it shouldn't take too much of your time. Before we let you go today, however, we wanted to talk a little bit about the survey we just completed. Over the last 2 weeks, we were running a cinema and COVID-19 survey just to find out when you Malaysians would be ready to go back to cinemas. And I have to say, some of the results were surprising, but most of them not. I guess for me, the most surprising result was about when you would be ready to go back to cinemas, because 42% of the over 1,000 people who we surveyed said that they would wait at least a month, and even then it would only be if there was something they really wanted to watch. 24% said they would wait until there was a cure for COVID-19, and 17% said they would wait 2 weeks. So that's the vast majority of people who are just going to wait and see lah, which is quite an interesting number, because I think local cinemas are already going to have a tough time given the slow trickle of movies coming their way. And I think they're going to have to resign themselves to the fact that it's going to be a slow day at the cinema every day for the foreseeable future. Only 17% said they would be happy to go back to cinemas immediately. But even those 17%, I don't know what they're going to be watching.
Mm.
Yeah. And I think even that 17% will be dependent on what's showing, right? If I'm not mistaken, TGV has announced they'll be rescreening Inception. So I think that might get some views. Even then, I don't know how many people.
Well, that was our next question, wasn't it? It was like, what'll bring you back? And most people said big blockbusters and reruns.
Yeah. So yeah, I was looking at Box Office Mojo's numbers for 2019. They give you international numbers as well. Yeah. And looking at the Malaysian box office, I mean, that's a very unsurprising statistic, because when you look at the leaps from week to week, the percentages increase. Every time the Malaysian box office like broke, say, $1 million US dollars in takings was because of a major release. So Captain Marvel, John Wick, Avengers Endgame, like you can market by those. Every other week is slow. And that's unsurprising because we know how Malaysians love this sort of content, right? And that's also in line with kind of foreign trends as well, which is why studios put in so much money into big blockbusters and the indie guys don't get much airtime, because they know that's the kind of stuff that brings in money. Cinemas themselves have invested quite a lot in trying to use their space for other events and activities. And I don't know if that's just going to have to fall by the wayside, because obviously no one's really interested. I mean,
I don't want to go to the cinema to watch Dota tournaments at 3 a.m. I mean, I wasn't going to do it before. The weird thing is now, as I live near a street full of bars and restaurants, and we've gone out walking a few times just to stretch our legs to see, look at all the idiots exposing themselves to COVID. And the weird thing is the silence, because all the TVs are off.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. Like, you see, because all the...
Because they've only subscribed for the Astro Sports package.
Yeah. They're not going to watch... Who goes to the pub to watch Friends? That might be an idea. Maybe I should go pitch them on this idea of like putting on SpongeBob cartoons or something. Because there's just all the TVs are black. They're just not on, which is just odd. But I think the first question responses, though, I think that reinforces the idea that everything is 2 weeks now. We've all got this thing in our head of like, it's a 2 week time for changes to have any impact on the COVID numbers. And it is like, you know, it was like, we're waiting for 2 weeks after Raya. We're waiting for 2 weeks after the hairdressers open. We're waiting for 2 weeks after everything. So it is, it's understandable. Also, we should say before we didn't have this in our survey because it came out after that, but like the new SOPs are, you have to be like no under 12s.
Yes. So is it the government SOPs? Because only GSE has announced that so far.
Is it? I don't know. Because
I don't know.
Every news portal in Malaysia can suck my balls because they say, oh, these people were arrested for breaking the SOPs. What were they doing? Give people know. Or the SOPs about this. They never just say SOPs, including under 12 should not go. So I thought I saw from GSE.
I think the cinema SOPs are only officially going to be out Monday.
That's what I heard as well. Yeah, so I think GSE has gone ahead and just made one announcement. So when you read our article on goggler.my, we've mentioned that so far GSE is the only one that's announced that under 12s and over 60s won't be allowed. Meanwhile, from our survey, 95% of parents told us that they won't be taking their children to the movies, which I think is disastrous for, say, Mulan. Which kind of relies on families and repeat viewings. And the repeat viewings thing, I mean, that's not a question we asked. But of course, you know, you may risk your life once to see Tenet, but are you going to go back and see it the second and third time like we did with Inception? I don't know.
The other thing about not bringing your kids to the cinema, it might have nothing to do with the SOPs or with, you know, being worried about their health. It might be that if you're going to the cinema, you want to get away from your kids after the last 3 months.
Correct. Also, you know, if this rule sticks, I mean, hey, less noise in the cinema.
There were some comments as well about no food in the cinema, right? Just for, I don't know.
There were quite a few people saying that they... Yeah, so essentially at the end of the survey, one of our final questions is a text box that says, assuming the expected SOPs, what else would you want to see? And I think quite a few people have said, they would like to see F&B be prohibited, essentially, because, you know, if you've got a face mask on, you can't eat. But if you've got food, you can't have your face mask on. Also, when you eat, you've got saliva flying all over the place. I don't know what these people are eating in the cinema, that their saliva's flying
particularly
aggressively, but...
But I think in general, I mean, there is flying spittle. So you want to cut that risk down. I don't think that'll be cinemas kind of rely on overpriced popcorn for revenue, so I don't see that happening unless it's an official government sanctioned SOP. But you know, maybe one way to mitigate risk would be what MBO at Tropicana Gardens does, which is that self-service counter thing. So you pick your own popcorn, you
pick
cashless
your own popcorn
payment.
So when you pick it up and it's like, oh, this one looks wet, and you put it back. And then
I was going to say, I don't trust Malaysians to not touch multiple.
See, that's the problem. As soon as you start thinking about this and talking about it, you're going to stay at home forever.
Yeah, or like people just coughing in the general vicinity of those large, uncovered boxes of popcorn.
Yeah, they opened the cabinet for popcorn and then just so happened to have a cough going.
I haven't heard any more about this. I think it was on the Tested podcast. They were talking about how the idea of, like, I haven't seen any change here yet, but the idea of going to the grocery store and touching stuff might be, go extinct. Like, you know, feeling up your avocados and actually mean the fruit, not the anything else. That's not a euphemism. You know, to see if they're soft like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I some, my local
supermarket. I'm just thinking euphemism. Yeah, feeling up your avocados, see if they're soft.
Hey, testicular cancer is real.
Check for tumors.
Yes.
To self-check.
But like the disaster fatigue is already sitting in places. The supermarket I go to was giving out gloves. You could be like Michael Jackson in the middle aisle with your one glove on, touching the fruit. But touching the fruit. It's the name of my spoken word album. That's gone away. They're just waving people through now. I've seen a couple of places where they're not even taking your temperature. It's like, ugh.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, cinemas have a really, really uphill task. I mean, the reality of it is that it's a catch-22 situation, right? If they don't open now, they run the risk of not opening ever. And then, of course, if they open now as well, then you're operating all of that electricity and you're paying overheads again. And if no one shows up, that's going to be problematic as well. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how the industry manages this and how the studios and distribution companies actually help out. What we've done in our article is, besides give you the results, we've taken the suggestions that you gave us as well and kind of formulated that into a series of recommendations that we've put at the bottom of each question that we've asked you. And so go to goggler.my and check it out and keep those suggestions coming. In case we've missed anything, we want to hear from you as well. And we will, of course, pass all of those on to the cinemas and distributors as well. So hopefully things go back to normal at some point soon.
Well, as normal as you can be.
Christopher Nolan, man.
Hmm?
2020, right? Christopher Nolan and Tenet. That's going to be a special point in cinema history because there'll be a chapter on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How that either saved the industry or essentially everybody went to watch that one movie and nothing ever again.
Yeah. And then how Tenet caused the end of human civilization.
Yeah, exactly. How Tenet caused the second wave.
Yeah.
All right. Keep your thoughts coming in. Let us know what you think of all the shows we've spoken about today. You can get in touch with us on all of our social medias. That's GogglerMY. Also on our website, goggler.my/contact. You can see Ian's review of 7500 there. You can see all of the stuff we've spoken about there. Go check out the website and keep talking to us. You can email us on podcast@goggler.my.
And do let us know if you're interested in watching Ju-on and you've seen those other J-horror movies from the 90s and 2000s. And if there's any you would recommend in the last 10 years, because I don't think I've seen that many recently that have been
okay.
Good.
So let me add to that. Let Ian know if you want him to watch any of those.
Yeah.
Don't give out my email.
Specifically Ian.
This is the Goggler Podcast signing out.